should have done that today.
I'll tell you some more about crystallography today. Crystallography is the word that you use to encompass the field of patterns in three dimensions. There's a thing that we call the unit cell in crystallography. And you can take the unit cell as the motif. Now, in crystallography, we are dealing with the locations of atoms or with molecules. And sometimes it's possible to put these atoms at the corners of certain geometrical shapes, three-dimensional shapes. Now, to try and let you in on what this is about, let's go back to two dimensions because that is easier. In two dimensions, you can fill the space. Let's see, it's not space in two dimensions. You can fill a plane with certain shapes. You cannot fill a plane with irregular shapes. I'm talking about identical shapes. But you can fill space with triangles. If I have a perfectly equilateral, that means all sides the same length, triangles, I can keep adding those together. I'm already getting this thing out of kilter. But it is possible, you see, with triangles that are exactly the same. Oh God, I really got out. I'm in trouble. Let me try again. I'll just draw it like this. That'll be easy. Anyway, you can see that with equal triangles, I can completely fill space. Not space, but this plane, two dimensions. When you come to the edge, you'll have something that's ragged. But where you're dealing with millions of atoms, billions, trillions, trillions of atoms, that's a minor point that you don't even worry about. I think it's also obvious to you that you can fill space with squares. Squares will add together over and over. And there are variations of the square. Rectangle, where you take the square and stretch it out in one dimension. So that this side is not the same length as that side, but there's a right angle at all of the corners. You can also fill space with that without any trouble. You can do likewise with a parallelogram, where this angle is not a right angle, but where this side equals that side in length, and this side equals that side in length. Two sides equal, and the other two sides equal the four sides of a parallelogram. If you try to fill space with a five-sided figure, you can't do it. You can't fill space. You'll end up with some gaps. If you get an equal-sided five-figure thing, and maybe that's why five-fold symmetry isn't allowed. Maybe that's a simple explanation of why you cannot have five-fold symmetry in these patterns. A hexagon can also fill space, and there may be some others. I keep talking about space because I'm used to talking about three dimensions in crystallography. We're talking about a two-dimensional surface, a plane. There may be some others that will also add together, leaving no vacant spots. Now, when you go to three dimensions, then it's a shape that can fill a space. Obviously, a cube can fill space. You can stack your kids' blocks on and on and on in all directions forever without any gaps. You can do the same with this kind of a shape, which comes out of the board, this rectangle coming out of the board, to have some dimension out here, some height to it. those would fill space. And if you imagine this parallelogram that is in the plane of the board, and I come up this way, I come up from each corner perpendicular to the board a given distance, those likewise could fill space. If I do that with a five-sided figure, it will not, but the hexagon will fill space. And if I come up in that dimension with a triangle, you can also fill all of space with that. And there are some other shapes that will also do that. But there are a limited and restricted number of these shapes that you can stack together, and there'll be no empty space. They'll stack perfectly together. Now, those things are called unit cells. I'm not going to get completely complex in this, and you don't always tell the whole truth when you try to make things simple. But it'll be the main idea. I'm approximately correct. We call some of these things the unit cell. Now, if you locate the atoms at the corners of a cubic unit cell, this is a simple cubic structure. Forget about the one in the middle for the moment. Blank that one out of your mind. I have here a block, just a cube, you see? Imaginary lines, if you want. And located at each apex is an atom, which we'll assume to be spherical. Now, actually, the atoms are larger than that. Here's a model of something like sodium chloride, where the red balls are sodium atoms, which are smaller than the chlorine atoms. It's difficult to tell what that structure is like because you can't see in there. The balls are eating up all the room. In these kind of structures, which scientists use, these atoms are not to scale. It's just to indicate that the center of an atom is located there. It's smaller than it should be, simply so you can see through things and see the center of the atoms, where the position is located. The truth picture is more like this picture here. And sometimes it's worthwhile getting some ping pong balls and tennis balls and other things and glue them together. And scientists are always doing that to visualize the structure. And then they'll make these stick models like this to also visualize the structure. Now, a scientist wants to know how many atoms are in his motif, the unit cell that he's going to repeat over and over again. Well, my motif is going to be this cube. I'm still ignoring that central body-centered atom. If I take a saw in my mind and saw right through there, saw through every plane right where this axis is, you can see that I'll end up with 1/8 of a sphere. Can you visualize that? Let me try to draw it. Well, wait a minute, we can do it here, I think. Yeah, we can do it in this. This has been extended. Assume that they're all the same kind of atoms. Some are painted silver in this network, which is a cubic lattice, which has been extended beyond the motif. Assume that all the atoms are the same. They're all red. All right, now look at an atom down in here. Now look, that atom belongs to this cell in part, and this cell, and this cell, and this cell. What I'm calling a cell is this thing that outlines the cube. And there are 8 cells surrounding that. So only 1/8 of the atom belongs to a cell. Can you see that well enough to tell that at this point? Pick one atom down in there deeply, and then count, see, down here on the bottom, you can count 4 cubes around that. And then up above, you can count 4 cubes. So that atom, 1/8 of it belongs to each of those cubes. And that would be true on every apex of a cube. So in a simple cubic structure, a cube has 8 apexes, or corners, if you like to call them corners, that's okay. And there's only 1/8 of the atom within them. So there's 1 atom total. So a scientist would say that in the simple cubic structure, there is 1 atom per unit cell. the unit cell being the motif. Now, can't you imagine taking that unit cell I just described, where you, in your mind, cut all these off? You can stack all those blocks together, and you end up with a pattern like this. And I can keep stacking blocks. Just keep stacking them all together, and this pattern will just be extended. Simple cubic pattern. Now, if I have an atom right in the center of the cube, that's the thing we talked about before as being body-centered cubic. Simple cubic we just discussed. Now, body-centered cubic. Now, every cube has an atom right in the very center. Now, I can keep stacking these together also, and I don't have a simple cubic pattern here, a body-centered pattern here. But I think you can visualize that you could just stack that together. Now, how many atoms per unit cell in that kind of a structure?
Two.
1/8 on each corner times 8 corners equals 1, and then a whole one in the center. So there would be 2 atoms per unit cell. Now I have face-centered cubic. Here's the cubic lattice again. But now in the face, exactly in the face, halfway in the plane of the face, there's an atom. And a cube has 6 faces. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. 6 faces to a cube. Now how many atoms are in each face? 3/8 of an atom, 9/10?
You mean including the corners or not?
I'm sorry, just right in the center of the face.
Half an atom.
There's half an atom. Can everyone see that? See, imagine a plane going right down the middle where these wires are, right down the axis of that. Half an atom. So there are 6 faces, so how many atoms total? 3, and then you count the 1 on the corner. So in, let's see, here we had 1 atom per unit cell, or per motif. There we have 2, and in the face-centered cubic, we will have 1/8 times 1, and then 3, for a total of 4. We won't get into any detail on that. I'm just showing you how these various kinds of things can be added up, and there'll be different numbers of atoms. That's important to a chemist and a crystallographer to have that information.
Do the sticks represent bonds?
Not necessarily, no. No, in this case, the sticks do not represent bonds. They're just holding the atoms in the appropriate place. Pretend that in this extended lattice, or this pattern, that all the atoms are yellow colored, they're all the same. Then that's what diamond would look like. We take a super microscopic chunk of diamond, and it would have that arrangement. See the tetrahedral bonds? 4 bonds to every carbon atom, everywhere. Everywhere there are 4 bonds. You look at a carbon well at the edge here, you see this would continue on with one up here. You get down inside, there will always be 4 bonds to a carbon atom, tetrahedrally arranged. Now, it's possible to look into here and find a unit cell that is cubic. If I orient that properly, I can get a unit cell that's cubic. This has its own name. It's called diamond cubic. We've had simple cubic, where we just had atoms at the corner. Body-centered cubic, where there were atoms at the corner and one right in the center. Face-centered, where there's one at the center. And that's true of the diamond structure. Pretend these atoms are all the same color. Can you see that there's an atom in each face of the cube? But in addition, in diamond, there's an atom here in what you'd call a quarter-quarter-quarter position. If I go from this point, 1/4 of the distance along this line, and then I come in a quarter of the distance, and I go up a quarter, I find an atom. You find it there, and there, and then transverse to it here and here. So we have diamond cubic, and they don't use initials for that, they just spell it out. Diamond cubic structure. How many atoms would we have in the diamond cubic structure per unit cell? I've heard 8 a couple of times. That's correct. 1/8 on each apex, on each corner of the cube, times 8. So that's 1. 1/2 in each of the 6 faces, that's 3 more, making 4. And then these 4 that are colored black are completely inside the cube. So that's 4 more, making a total of 8 atoms per unit cell.
So can you pick that out on this thing?
Well, it's hard to do. Let's try and orient. It may not be big enough to do it, really. Sometimes the unit cell chosen is not unique. It's possible to choose a rhombohedral shape for diamond, which will also fit the circumstances. Sometimes there can be a dual choice or greater, and so the scientist arbitrarily chooses one as the standard, and they've chosen the cubic as a standard. I was mentioning before class that it looked like somebody was trying to pick out a unit cell in here that is related to the hexagonal cell. It's called rhombohedral. Let's see if we can pick out that cubic relationship in here. Well, let's see. I'm going to let, if I can get one on the bottom. All right, let's see. It's hard to do because I've tried to do it before. Let's see. Two came in the back, me. Let's see. This doesn't extend into space quite far enough to do it. Now let's see. Try it. Okay. That's the inverse. Well, what I'm trying to do here. Can you see that zigzag structure going like that across the bottom? See that going like that? I was trying to pick one of those out as a starting place. Now, okay. See, I've got a zigzag structure going right there like that. So that's about the way to hold the thing like that. And trouble is, this is the reverse from that, which is okay. I need to come over one more atom. There needs to be another atom down here. So I would have that atom and that atom. The thing doesn't extend in space far enough to really pick it out. This is the pattern of graphite. Again, pretend all the atoms are the same, all the same color. Now remember I told you that graphite has 3 bonds equal like a honeycomb in a plane. Can you see that? And then that there was a weak bond, which is longer distance connecting all the planes. Now believe it or not, that is related somewhat to the diamond structure, and we'll transform the diamond if it's subjected to a high enough pressure and tension in the presence of a catalyst. Well, now we want to get to the subject of X-ray diffraction, and we need to talk about the planes. I told you if you had a model, it would be possible in any model to look through it in various directions and see planes of atoms. Now, there are three planes there that are rather obvious, very definite. Now, if I rotate that this way, you'll be able to see some other planes. Can you see some other planes that direction that come? See the wires line up as I rotate that before your eye?
It's all the black.
All the black balls. Now there are other planes in there that'll be harder to see. I don't know that we can bring any of them into position to see them or not. I can see one right through there. Now not all the atoms need line up, but there will be certain planes of atoms. And if you twist that through space various directions, there will be a certain number of planes that will line up. Now, to find out what these structures are like, scientist uses X-ray diffraction. X-rays were discovered about the time, maybe 1900, along in there. In 1914, Sir William Bragg, Great Britain, and his son, same name, William Bragg Jr., both scientists, discovered that you could use X-rays to tell where the atoms were located in crystals. Now I need to launch into a little side discussion before we continue on with this. There's a phenomenon in science known as diffraction. The common phenomenon that you may be familiar with is diffraction of sunlight by raindrops to make the rainbow. You can do the same thing by taking a prism of transparent glass, triangular shape, extends out from the board this way. If you let the so-called white light from the sun shine on that prism in a spot, take a beam like from a flashlight, only take a real narrow, fine beam, there is a range of colors in the white light. We refer to them by their frequency or by their wavelength. I'm going to have to use some names here. Frequency. Wavelength and velocity. The thing that we call light belongs to a phenomena that we call electromagnetic radiation. Electromagnetic radiation. Light is one little tiny area in the whole spectrum of the thing we call electromagnetic radiation. Now, the true nature of light may not be known by man. Light is a puzzle. Electromagnetic radiation in general is a puzzle to man. Just what is it that comes to our eye that we can detect? You can see it, you can't feel it, you can't grab hold of it. You can use various kinds of scientific instruments to recognize its presence. There's electromagnetic radiation that your eye cannot see. If we draw a long line here representing the known electromagnetic radiation, there'd be a little tiny area in here that our eye can see that we call visible light. If I refer to wavelength, there are several ways this scale could be constructed. Then here, let's say this is increasing wavelength. red here that your eye can see has a wavelength of 7,000 angstroms. Violet, which is on the other end of what your eye can see, has a wavelength of 4,000 angstroms. Remember, an angstrom is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. A centimeter is a distance about that long. And 10 to the minus 8 centimeter is 1, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You've got to divide that distance up into 1/100 millionth of that distance to get one angstrom. Beyond the red is what we call infrared. And we have photographic films which can see infrared. If the infrared has a long enough wavelength, you can feel it. You can't see it, but you can feel it. If you have an iron on, ironing your dress, you can put your hand an inch or so away from the iron, and you feel something, feel warm. You feel what we call warmth. That has a wavelength out here of something like 10,000 angstroms. Well, you go out beyond what your hand can detect in the form of warmth, radiant electromagnetic radiation coming from something like a hot iron. Then we get into devices like radar. And there it takes another kind of a technique to determine how long those wavelengths are. And then you get to still longer wavelengths and you have radio waves. And these are broken up into, you know, FM band, radio wave. Television approaches the long radar wavelengths. But they get longer and longer and longer into what we call a radio wavelengths until the length of the wave may get to be 100 miles long. And the Navy uses radio waves that are that long for communicating with submarines and ships at sea. Now as we go to shorter and shorter wavelengths on the other end, we'll come to ultraviolet light, which your eye cannot see, but which photographic films can see. And then going beyond ultraviolet light, you'll get down to X-rays, and then still shorter on down here, you'll get to things we call gamma rays. All right, now, I've been talking about wavelengths. With these various gizmos, things that can be radios and tune into stations, radar, things like that, photographic films. Radiation seems to be a wave, just like a wave on a pond. When you throw a rock in a pond, you get a ripple proceeding out. Now, some of these concepts we have to try and relate to everyday experience. Then once you get some new concepts in your mind, then you can relate some more way out concepts to those concepts. You can also relate these things to a violin string. How many here play violins or some kind of a thing like that? All right, now, sound waves are not electromagnetic waves. They need a medium to be transported through. You need the air, or you need water. Now you need something solid. You need liquid, solid, or gas for sound waves to go through. Electromagnetic waves need nothing. They can go right through a vacuum. So sound is something different, but we can make an analogy that's the same. The violin string vibrates, and it makes pressure pulses in the air, which are equivalent to the ripple in a pond when you throw a rock in it. Now, with your violin, you put energy into your string with a horsehair bowl. And if you look at the horsehair under a microscope, it's like a rasp. It's like a file. The horsehair has little barbs that come up on it. And so you have a couple of hundred horsehairs in there. And if you push that across the string, the little barb catches the string and pushes it back and then lets it slip. It's a stick slip phenomenon. And that puts some stretch in the string and then it comes back. So you impart energy to the string with that. You have to put energy in somehow or other. But the string is so taut, and it has a certain distance depending on where your finger is of a certain length, and it will vibrate according to its length and its tautness, and emit a certain frequency of sound. The shorter the string, the higher the sound. The tighter the string, the higher the sound. Well, those we call waves. And you can do experiments in sound to get a ripple effect in substances, just like you do throwing things on water. Sound travels about 700 feet per second. Electromagnetic radiation travels 186,000 miles per second. That's the velocity, 186,000 miles per second. Sound, which is a different category than electromagnetic radiation, but which can be spoken of in an analog way with electromagnetic radiation, only 700 feet per second. Let's see, they're 5,000 feet per mile, so it's only about a seventh of a mile per second.
Isn't it?
Question?
I thought it was 1,100 feet per second or so. It's roughly 700 miles an hour.
I think you're right. Sound goes 700 miles per hour. Let's figure out what that is.
It's 1,100 feet per second.
It's 1,100 feet per second. Okay. Or about 1,100 feet per second. The wavelength of a wave. Well, imagine a wave to be that kind of a ripple. We call it a sine wave. You can describe that ripple with a mathematical equation involving the trigonometric function of the sine. So you call it a sine wave. The wavelength is the distance between the crests. The wavelength is usually given by the symbol lambda in science. Speaking about electromagnetic radiation, the Greek letter lambda means the wavelength. The frequency is how many of these waves come by some fixed measuring station here per second. I stand here with my stopwatch. And as the electromagnetic radiation comes by, I count the number of bumps or crests that come by per second. That's the frequency. Usually given by the symbol nu. The velocity of electromagnetic radiation is given the symbol c. In the metric system, c is a velocity of, I forgot the number, you got it wrong? 3 × 10 to the 10th centimeter per second, isn't that it? I think that's it. 3 × 10 to the 10th centimeters per second. Now, man has become awfully smart in measuring these fast velocities. You can't believe it. My son-in-law, Marty Neal, works for Hewlett-Packard down in California, and he works in a division where they try to measure the shortest possible events. They make clocks, timers, better than that. They make timers that can time events. Now, if I turn on my flashlight right now, this very billionth of a second, it will go around the Earth if it would shine that far, and if the gravitational field would bend it around the Earth. It goes 7 times around the Earth in 1 second. And electricity does the same. If I push on my button here on my telegraph, that electrical signal will go around the Earth 7 times, 25,000 miles around the equator. It'll go 7 times in 1 second. Now, these radiations travel so fast, so we don't have to worry about it. We can talk to somebody in New York, and we don't notice any particular delay. If you talk to somebody on the moon, 250,000 miles away, there will be a delay. Remember when the astronauts were up there? Do you recall a little delay? Somebody say something and there'd be a delay in coming back. Well, 250,000 miles is quite a ways, you see.
How long is that delay?
Well, it would be 180,000 divided into 250,000 seconds.
Each way is 2.5 seconds.
250,000 divided by 186.
Multiplied by 2.
Oh yeah, it's got to go there and come. Well, I was just talking about the one way. Yeah, if.
But if you're talking to him.
That's right. If you're talking to him, that's right. 2.7 seconds. That's what you said, didn't you? 2.7 seconds. So that'd be noticeable. A second is the time it takes you to say 1,001, 1,002, 1,003. You'd notice that. Jeff?
Like 2 seconds, something like 45 minutes, about 45 minute lag in communications.
When they get out to Jupiter or something, it's 8 minutes to the sun. It takes electromagnetic radiation, 8 minutes. If you turn on your flashlight now, the light wouldn't reach the sun for 8 miles. The sun wouldn't know it reached it when it got there. It's so powerful compared to your flashlight. Well, its frequency is a constant number. Isn't that kind of unusual and amazing? Doesn't matter what the radiation is. X-rays, gamma rays, visible light, red, infrared, radar, radio, ultra-long wavelength radio. No matter what it is, it travels at that constant velocity of 186,000 miles per second. But it can have a different wavelength. And that's what I tried to point out to you there. Now, wavelength and velocity are related by the formula. The wavelength times the velocity, I'm sorry, the wavelength times the frequency is equal to that constant velocity. The longer the wavelength, I got that backwards. The longer the wavelength, the higher the frequency. Yeah, that
the longer
makes
the frequency. The longer the wavelength, the lower the frequency.
No. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's right. So when this is longer, that goes lower, so the two multiplied together equals C. The longer the wavelength, the lower the frequency. So light, under proper experimental circumstances, seems to be a wave. One, light seems to be a wave. But if you do a different kind of experiment, light seems to be a particle, seems to be a bullet. Light seems to be a particle. How do you spell bullet?
That's right.
As you see something, the little tiny bullets ripping off from whatever you're looking at, and they come and hit your eye, and your eye detects them. Einstein made that discovery about 1905 in what is called the photoelectric effect. Since that time, there have been a lot of experiments that have grown out of these things that they call cyclotrons, synchrotrons, high-energy physics. The field of high-energy physics has performed a number of experiments that seem to indicate that electromagnetic radiation is a particle. So science does not know which it is. And that makes quite a paradox and quite a dilemma for science. But science can always solve its problems in the field of mathematics. So there is an equation that we won't get involved with called the de Broglie equation. De Broglie was an Italian. We decided to resolve this dilemma, even though your mind can't resolve it. You can resolve it in mathematics that describe the phenomenon. Broglie's equation relates these two experiments, that some experiments light seems to be a wave and some experiments light seems to be a particle. Okay?
So I forgot what the name of the thing is, cyclotron?
Cyclotron, synchrotron.
It's called something like that, but where I live, they have one of those at the laboratory or something. And I just hear it mentioned in that song.
Where do you live?
Los Alamos, Mexico.
Oh, yeah. If you live in the San Francisco area, down around Palo Alto or Cupertino, that area. The new highway, 280, runs right over a linear accelerator. The cyclotrons and the betatrons and the synchrotrons and all the other things, they chase electrons around an orbit that is usually a circle. Sometimes it's an ellipse, but usually a circle. And they get these particles going as fast as they can, like electrons and protons. In the linear accelerator at Stanford, they just have one big long thing that's, what, 1.5 miles long, and it goes under that road. I saw it last time I was down there. And there they just accelerate this electron, just like you do in a TV tube. Same principle, except they get a lot more complex. They get an electron or some other particle, and they attract it down the other end with magnets and electric charges, and then it hits something down the other end, an atom, for example, and flies to pieces, and they try to find out what the fragments are. Real high-class experiments, like throwing rocks at a greenhouse and then trying to find out what the greenhouse looks like. You do it blindfolded. It's just about that hard, but that's what they do. They bombard atoms with these atomic particles, and then with various tricks try to find out what went on. And they have to work in fast time. I didn't finish that fast time thing about my son-in-law, Marty. These timers that they have, they can switch on a beam of light with by electronic means. Now, a beam of light will only travel 1.75 of an inch in the time that they can cut it off. So they can measure that short a time. Just the time it takes light to go 1.75 inch, they can measure. That's a pretty small time. That's in the... We have kilo and...
It takes 4 nanoseconds.
Nanoseconds, that's what I was trying to think.
Meters, so that's...
It's less than a nanosecond. A nano being 10 to the 9th. 10 to the minus 9th of a second. That's a 1 over 1 with 9 zeros behind it. Well, more of the story on electromagnetic radiation. I'm not moving too fast here. There's an interesting thing, we're back to this word diffraction, about electromagnetic radiation. If I have a radar screen that's made up of a mesh. You've seen radar screens at airports, haven't you? I used to work with radar during World War II. That's when I first learned these kind of things. Say those are squares in there. You notice the antenna that's sort of elliptical shape and sort of curved and spins around at the airports. It's full of holes, isn't it? The electromagnetic radiation, radar wavelength, thinks that's just as solid as a mirror. And here's the trick. If the wavelength, that is the distance between the crests, is greater than the distance between the solid things, the framework. If that distance is bigger than this hole, it doesn't know the hole is there. If the wavelength is greater than the size of the hole, it's as though it were solid. Now the reason they make the radar thing that way instead of solid is so it doesn't have any wind resistance. On ships during the war, the radar would be way up there, maybe 250 feet high on a tower. And the radars would be much bigger in those days. This huge thing would have been a sail. The ship would have been blown backwards when the engine was trying to take it forwards. So you build it full of holes so there's no wind resistance to the thing. And as long as the wavelength of your electromagnetic radiation is greater than the width of that hole, then that appears to be a solid. Now I've told just a little bit of a fib. For that to really appear to be a solid, this wave, really solid, this wave ought to be about 4 times. If this distance is landed, it ought to be about four. It's a bit of a relative thing. And if it's only about a quarter of this wavelength in here, then it will go through. If, however, the wavelength is near the same as this, then you get an interaction that we call diffraction. Have any of you ever seen a diffraction grating? Okay. A diffraction grating will do the same thing as this glass prism. It will diffract the light of the various wavelengths. The prism, the glass prism, diffracts the light of the highest wavelength, the highest frequency. That'd be the smaller wavelength, the most. So you get violet down here, and you get the red up here going about straight through. Violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red is what we mean the colors in there. A diffraction grating will do the same. If I take a mirror, a front surface mirror, I take a piece of glass, and this is a very flat, optically flat piece of glass, and I coat it with aluminum or silver or some other substance, a very perfect coating of aluminum on the front surface, not on the back. It's called a front surface mirror. Then I go to Cambridge, Massachusetts to a company there who has what they call a ruling engine. The ruling engine has a tiny diamond needle, even smaller than a phonograph needle, very sharp point. And that ruling engine moves that little needle across here and scrapes off